when I decided it was time for a third book, 7 or 8 years had passed, well, 6 years from the time of the second book. So the sequence was, in 2000, I published Inside the Olympic Industry, Power, Politics and Activism. And then 2 years later, being an Aussie by birth and by citizenship, I published The Best Olympics Ever, ? Social Impacts of Sydney 2000. And then, as time went on, I saw that the patterns that I had identified and documented in books 1 and 2 were still appearing in bid cities and host cities. And despite the so-called reform that the IOC engaged in, very little had changed. And repeatedly, bid cities and host cities, or bid committees and organising committees, were models of lack of transparency and lack of accountability. Very little changed on those fronts. So I thought it was time for a third book. So I'm looking at, in Olympic Industry Resistance, the threat posed by the Olympics to the basic civil rights and freedoms of residents in bid and host cities and bid and host provinces and bid and host countries, and most specifically the right to a free press and freedom of assembly. As an aside, I was in Whistler on Saturday at the invitation of Whistler Watch, and they organised a public event in the library. They put the posters up on posts in the Whistler village with a contact person and phone number. That woman was phoned very soon afterwards, threatened with fines if she didn't race around tearing down the signs. She did so. She found many of them had already been removed. There's no sort of public space for dissent in Whistler, and the library gave the space to the group for my talk, but didn't endorse the event, refused to go that far. So the other aspect, the other serious trends that I identified in the previous books and continued in this book was the criminalising of poverty and the housing and homelessness problems that are associated with hosting the Olympics. And probably more importantly, what I set out to do was to record the work, the tireless and courageous work of Olympic watchdog groups and anti-Olympic groups in the US, in Canada, Australia, Europe and elsewhere as they challenge the Olympic industry. And those grassroots groups and coalitions have been working to raise public awareness about the dangers of hosting the Games for at least 2 decades, probably longer. In fact, the picture on the cover of my first book shows some of my colleagues from the Breadknot Circuses Coalition in Toronto opposing Toronto's bid for the 1996 Games. And that IOC meeting was in Tokyo, and some local Tokyo activists joined in solidarity with the Breadknot Circuses people, and the picture on the cover shows a march, a protest march in Tokyo while the IOC was meeting. So I use the term Olympic industry to draw attention to the characteristics that it shares with other global corporations, many of which are Olympic sponsors. So I'm challenging the benign-sounding pseudo-religious terms that we are inundated with. Olympic movement, Olympic family, Olympic spirit. They're terms that promote mystique and elitism, and they obscure the power and profit motives that underlie everything Olympic. There's a parallel with the progressive voices in the 1980s in my field, sports sociology, who introduced the concept of the fitness industry to reflect how the fitness initiatives of the 70s had been co-opted and corporatized in most Western countries. And so I'm saying Olympic industry to draw attention to the fact that sport is just the tip of the iceberg when we think about the Olympics. So we've seen, as since the year 2000, ongoing campaigns by anti-globalisation activists to address the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And there's an overlap between the anti-globalisation movements and activists in Olympic bid and host cities who are scrutinising the connections between the Olympic industry and global capitalism. And some of those links are the gentrification of low-income inner-city neighbourhoods, sounds familiar, the inflation of rents and real estate prices. And as an aside, when I gave my talk in Whistler, sort of more a community talk rather than a university-sponsored talk, I began by commenting on how, when I'd been preparing, I found on my laptop notes from a talk that I gave at the University of New South Wales in Sydney in the year 2000 when I was a visiting scholar there, sort of biting the hand that fed me because they knew I was a critic and I did the research there for part of the research there for the Sydney book. I had 4 or 5 pages of point form notes that I used in a presentation I gave at that university in May 2000, and virtually every one is applicable as I speak in Vancouver today and in Whistler when I spoke on Saturday. So much has stayed the same. It's a very disturbing and disappointing situation, and surely a adequate cause for mobilisation of community groups to rise up and protest, and I'll get to that. So in the first part of the book, Olympic Industry Resistance, I look at community resistance in Barcelona, Atlanta, Sydney, Salt Lake City and Athens, Beijing, Vancouver and London, and the unsuccessful bid cities of New York and Toronto. Unsuccessful in the sense they didn't win the games, successful in the sense that the activism was a factor, and who knows how big a factor. Journalists often ask me, do I think that Breadnut Circuses was the cause of Toronto's 2 failed bids? And I say, well, people like Richard Pound or Paul Henderson, who was head of the first bid committee, love to blame Breadnut Circuses, so we'll take the credit, but I think it was bigger than that. Who knows? The voting procedures are so bizarre and obscure and cloaked in secrecy that it would be impossible to tell what factors cause what, how individual IOC members vote. So the case studies that I present in the book show, and I have some discussion of Vancouver, but I wrote the book in finished the final edit in early 2008, so a lot has gone under the bridge since then. Politicians, developers, corporate leaders and Olympic supporters use the Olympics as a catalyst for urban redevelopment and infrastructure projects, largely at taxpayers' expense. The poorest neighbourhoods are the prime targets. The displacement of low-income residents, the destruction of long-standing working-class communities prompts little concern on the part of those with more power and privilege. Economic benefits accrue to developers, resort and hotel owners, the real estate industry, big business, while the poor disproportionately bear the burden. In most recent Olympics, about half of the budget has incurred public subsidy, that means tax money, and tax increases have persisted, as we know with Montreal, for decades to pay for often underused or unused facilities and infrastructure. There's a favourite word among Olympic boosters, legacy. A legacy, according to the dictionary, is something material or immaterial that is, quote, bequeathed or handed down by predecessors. But in the Olympic industry rhetoric, it's usually referring to infrastructure or housing or sporting facilities that are presented as some kind of windfall profit, something that kind of falls from the sky, a gift from the IOC or from some mysterious body out there. And the fact that public money pays a huge chunk of that that so-called legacy is overlooked. There's no free lunch. Taxpayers get what they pay for. And in the case of Vancouver Whistler, there was no plebiscite to decide if the top infrastructure spending priority should be the Sea to Sky Highway, which slurped up a few million, if taxpayers throughout the province had been asked, they quite probably would have put some other or several other projects at the top of their wish list and not necessarily the Cedar Sky Highway. Then Olympic bid boosters and the politicians who support them can argue that the improvement, the expensive projects like highways, airports, buses and train lines, stadiums and so on, were all in the planning stages long before they started to work on the bid, and so they're not in the budget. We see that story over and over again. This wasn't an Olympic expense. We're not going to put this in the Olympic budget because we were going to do this ages ago. With the customary lack of transparency and accountability, citizens can't have difficulty mounting counter-arguments, but the boosters lack credibility if they try to persuade residents that a complete raft of Olympic projects sprang fully formed from their collective foreheads at precisely the same moment they announced the formation of the bid committee. The white elephant problem is a classic one because you can't pick and choose which Olympic facilities you'd like to build that would be useful later on for your residents in a particular country or region. Ski jump and luge are quite possibly the top potential white elephants after winter games, and Calgary has proved that to some extent. After summer games, velodromes are a favourite white elephant. The one in Montreal was converted to a biosphere. Another so-called legacy is civic pride. Sure, if you are more privileged, you can have the luxury of experiencing civic pride when overseas visitors come to your city and enjoy the spectacle, the party that you put on. If you're a low-income tenant or a homeless person, you're not likely to feel much civic pride. On the contrary, the basic freedoms of, particularly of vulnerable populations, are routinely violated in Olympic host cities. Not just in Beijing, where people were forcibly removed from temporary, even permanent housing. There have been forcible removals in virtually every recent host city, and they're often, as in the case of Athens, for example, the Roma communities that were long-standing, same in London too, travellers and Roma people, who had lived in caravans on land and lived peacefully often for decades, who were not compensated, who sometimes just came home after travelling and found their shelters razed to the ground. In 2007, there was a 3-year study released by the Centre on Housing Rights and Evictions in Geneva, and it presented indisputable evidence of the negative impacts on low-income renters and homeless people in every Summer Olympic Games host city since 1988, that those problems included displacement, forced evictions, escalating housing costs, reduced availability of affordable housing, and the criminalising of poverty and homelessness. They looked at Seoul, Barcelona, Atlanta, Sydney, Athens, Beijing, and London, and along with my research on Sydney, we have documented the displacement of about 2 million people since the late 1980s, and that didn't include Vancouver because that report was done beforehand. And it was done before the final tally for Beijing. They had 1.25 million already documented when they released the report, and they predicted another 250,000 in the year 2008, and probably about 400,000 migrants whose temporary housing in the urbanised core was demolished. So we hear the rhetoric from Olympic industry boosters that the Olympics will solve a city's housing problems. So you get a bid for a Games that will happen 7 years down the line, and I saw this happen with Toronto, and they'll promise 1,200 units of geared-to-income housing. It's a drop in the bucket when you look at the numbers of people on waiting lists for subsidised housing in the city, in the province, And they need that now, not 7 years down the line, but it makes it more palatable to throw in some geared to income housing, affordable housing, Whistler's Olympic Village, the townhouses go for about 400,000, which is comparable to the townhouses in Homebush Bay in Sydney prior to the games. That was the Athletes Village that was then converted. So building housing that will then down the line become subsidized housing is a promise that does not always materialize. In London, before there were any direct impacts of Olympic construction or beautification, there were 11,000 homeless people and 60,000 in precarious housing. That was in 2005 when they got the games, before the projects and the evictions started. And among the more glaring examples in London, and this was a year ago when I was documenting this, community gardens, soccer fields, and a housing co-op, a purpose-built housing co-op, one of the most successful in Europe, were demolished to make way for Olympic parking lots and other Olympic projects. In Whistler, a wetland, a fairly rare segment of wetland, is being paved over to make way for a depot for the coaches. Now, there's always the promise that one of the legacies, the sort of less tangible, but it's always on the list, will be that the increase in facilities, the facilities that are left after the games leave town, and the spectacle and the excitement of hosting a games in your city will mean that there'll be a dramatic increase in sport and physical activity participation among children and young people and adults for years to come. A friend and colleague of mine, Christine Tui, is at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. Although we're friends and colleagues, she is on the other end of the spectrum around the Olympics and has volunteered for many, many games and was in fact a member of the Sydney Organising Committee for the Olympic Games. She had the task of writing the final report. So she isn't a critic, not my style of critic. She did some research examining the impact of hosting Sydney 2000 Olympics and Paralympics on participation in sport and physical activity. It was hard for her to get data because there was an unpublished report done by the government and it was only for insiders, although she has quoted some from it because she wasn't sufficiently inside to be able to have access. And there was a report done by a private independent research company, the Sweeney Report, and the results were quite stunning. There was no increase in Australians' participation in Olympic sports, in the summer Olympic sports that are on the summer program. The greatest increases in the period post-2000 were in non-Olympic sports, and there was greater passive involvement, more couch potatoes watching TV or more bums on the seats in the stands, in the stadiums. That's not a positive legacy. I don't need to spell that out. So getting closer to home with Vancouver, some of this you do already know, so I start off in the section on Vancouver in the book. I start off with former Mayor Sam Sullivan and the council and the public disorder, law and order approach that they engaged in, and the November 2006 report of release of the so-called Project Civil City report, with very little substantive evidence, the kind of thing that if a student of mine gave me a paper based on that kind of flimsy evidence, they'd probably be sent to rewrite it. The report asserted that public disorder was a widespread and growing problem, and that approach just ignored the community, the successful community-based work, particularly in the Downtown East Side, addressing poverty, homelessness and drug abuse, and research evidence showing decreases in every major crime indicator in the preceding 10 years, but allegedly there was a growing problem of public disorder. Sullivan denied that initially denied the recommendations were driven by the Olympic agenda of street cleanups, and every recent host city has had street cleanups of homeless people, sex trade workers, people with visible drug problems or whatever. In this report, members of the public were clearly differentiated from the other, and the other were the unfortunate women and men who were demonised because they lived in poverty or because they were homeless or because they had mental health problems and addictions. But the public was implied, it was the report implied that the public was law-abiding citizens, particularly Downtown Business Improvement Association members who were concerned about urban decline. And the report aimed at increasing the public's sense of personal safety, not homeless people's sense of personal safety, which arguably was threatened more by this kind of approach, which was victim-blaming for a start. The report reinforced the long-standing characterization of homeless people as some kind of urban vermin whose unsavory habits, garbage picking, public urination, sleeping in parks, should be eliminated. And as we speak, people engaging in those survival strategies because they don't have a shelter and or they have various other problems are getting ticketed by the police for their behaviours. Even giving money to panhandles was identified as having negative impacts, and the report suggested a public awareness campaign to educate non-homeless people not to give money to homeless people. There was a disturbing recommendation about boosting an informal private security network so that city employees, parking ticket enforcement personnel and garbage collectors would be, quote, the new ears and eyes on the street. So you add them to the local police and the security personnel and the waste watch program that the public employees were going to get so they could work with police and report criminal activities. And you have those ambassadors that are ostensibly to sort of do PR to tourists and closed circuit television. And you'll have, they have round the clock surveillance of homeless people, just like Atlanta. And my friend and colleague Anita Beatty, coordinator of the Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless, has documented the aftermath in Atlanta and indeed in many major cities in the US. The privatization of policing in Atlanta during and after the games, the privatization of public space, she argues quite convincingly to me that it's a form of class control, and in fact in the case of Atlanta, race control, because African American men constitute the majority of homeless people. And so just 2 years after Atlanta hosted the games, there were bylaws in 50 cities criminalizing the behaviors that are associated with poverty and homelessness. And by 2000, a major, most urban space, particularly Woodruff Park, which used to be a haven for homeless people, but in the downtown, most of the urban space was privatized, taken over by Georgia State University, patrolled by university security staff who ticketed van drivers distributing food to homeless people. The mayor even attempted to have a policy banning, quote, feeding the homeless in public. It sort of sounds like those things, you know, in waterfront towns saying, don't feed the seagulls, don't feed the homeless, on the grounds that it was a health hazard. She wasn't successful with that, but Anita says that was the chief legacy of the summer of 1996. And by 2006, Nearly 70 US cities had criminalized things like begging, lying down in public places. 5 US cities had banned food distribution in public places. So that is something not to look forward to for Vancouver, and I guess it's sort of self-evident that I support and applaud the work of the frontline workers and the Olympic Resistance Network and anyone who is working as advocates for people who cannot speak for themselves and fight for themselves.